It's December 11th, 2023, and you're listening to the Final Cut Podcast, presented by the Rough Draft Podcast Network. I just wanted to do a Jon Stewart intro for some reason. I just really wanted to do the Daily Show. I miss the late 2000s when Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart were the best place to get news, and it was funny and also terrifying, and they made a lot of fun at Glenn Beck, and I went to that awesome rally they had in Washington, D.C. to make fun of all the Tea Partyists, and then all the Tea Partyists turned into Nazis and ruled the government for 4 years, and yeah, the world is sad, and I can't think of a better analogy and a better thought to start this podcast, where you guys have already read the title. We're going to talk about Napoleon today. I haven't even pretended that we're going to talk about anything else because I said it on the last episode. It's in the title. You all know what we're here for. And Chase Wassenaar, my good friend and co-host, today's been a fucking day, my guy. Please tell me your day has gone better.
I can't make promises that I can't keep. So I hope that the day that this is released is going well for me. It's been a tumultuous period. You know, I'm sure a lot of people are dealing with, seasonal depression and just the general stuff around this time of year. But you know what? We watched a film that reminds us that one, things have always been bad. And two, it gave us the best quote that the film industry is capable of giving us this year. You think you're so great just because you have boats? Which, 10 out of 10, peak cinema, worth the admission price on its own.
This is why you don't put your best lines in the fucking trailer. That right there. You think you're better than me because you have fucking boats. Fucking brilliant. But Chase, no, I know at the beginning of the podcast I said today it's December 12th. In reality, it's December 8th as we are recording this, and we're not going to talk about football on next week's episode of Steam Cleaners because we have a special guest and we do not want to subject them to our terrible football takes. But Chase, it's been a little bit of a wild day in the NFL in terms of hot takes happening in the media, just starting with like the least hot take possible. Multiple high-ranking executives from rival teams believe that Bill Belichick would warrant as much as a first-round draft pick if he was traded, to which somebody asked at the top right now on Reddit on this day, what's stopping Bill Belichick from trading himself?
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Because he's the GM. There's no way he'd give up such a precious asset to go take over a team. Like, he would be making the team he's now on worse. It's almost like there's a clear conflict of interest when you have the coach and the GM be the same guy. Weird.
It would be pretty funny to be like Bill Belichick calls whoever, you know, the Dean Spanos, who owns the Chargers, and is like, yeah, Dean, if you give the New England Patriots a first round pick, I'll come coach Justin Herbert and turn him into Tom Brady 2.0. And then Dean Spanos would be like, Bill, why didn't you just do that with Mac Jones?
Well, no, here's what you say. It's like, hey, team that I would much rather coach this year because the Patriots are trash and are going to be bad for a while because the football gods have blessed us for too long and now no longer shine their light upon us. I'll come coach you guys for a seventh. You don't have to renegotiate my contract. I'd rather be with you. And you can give up basically nothing. And since I'm the GM, I'll say yes. Like, is that a thing that he can just do? Because why would he give up a first for himself when he could give up the bare minimum for himself? Hey, I'll trade myself to your team for cash considerations. How about that? Like, fucking wild that that's a thing that you could do in theory.
I mean, why wouldn't he just fire himself? Still get paid by the Patriots and then go sign with someone else. I don't fucking know.
Well, no. Most people, when you're fired, if you get signed by another team, the team that fired you no longer is culpable to your contract. That's why the best thing you can be is a fired coach that doesn't get hired elsewhere because they're no longer as... I mean, it depends on his deal. I don't know the makings of Bill Belichick's specific coaching deal, but I do know it seems like a conflict of interest that he could basically go to whatever team he'd rather coach and say, hey, you know all those Super Bowls that I won? Give the Patriots a 7th and I'll come over. Just seems like a thing you should be able to do.
But Chase, that's not even the most ridiculous thing to happen. See, another thing that happened today is that former Houston Texans quarterback and current New Orleans Saints quarterback's brother, David Carr, said he thought Marcus Mariota would be better and more productive for the Eagles than Jalen Hurts, to which a former teammate of his, Vonte Leach, responded, hey Carr, aren't you the quarterback who didn't know the plays when I played for Houston? Short memory, huh?
Yeah, I mean, but see, the problem with that one is that it's so transparent that he was just hoping to get engagement from mad Philly fans, and they gave him exactly what he wanted, right? I'm sure he got more followers and more tweets and more eyes on him as a human being than he has gotten at any point in his career as an NFL analyst before this, because he said the thing that he knew would make a lot of people angry, and you and I listen to a lot of podcasts that break down how profitable that idea is. I don't know. I don't want to, like, downplay how dumb that is, but it feels very manufactured to me and like, great, we've given him exactly what he wanted, which was more attention, because no one who could hear the thing that he said could believe that he meant it in earnestness.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you know what the real craziest thing is, Walter, and I think we can both agree, given the news of the day, the craziest thing is that the Falcons are heading to the playoffs at 6-6 as of right now. Kings of Shit Mountain, baby, let's go!
Oh, look at us. See, Chase, I do understand that being the King of Shit Mountain, you know, it's totally understandable why you would want to rate, you know, why you would want to be content with that, right? Why you'd be like, you know what, at least it's the playoffs. I'm sure you guys will enjoy the drubbing that you get at the hand of the Detroit Lions. But, you know, it is what it is, right? You're going to make the playoffs. You're better than the Aints. And
honestly, shout out to you for thinking we'll get to the Lions, when the real answer is that as the fourth seed, we'll get beaten to death by the Dallas Cowboys. We're going to lose.
Oh, that's true, right?
We're going to lose to Dak Prescott by 3 touchdowns. It's going to be great.
You guys will have a home game against them. Oh, my God.
It'll be great. I can't wait. What a terrible division. What a crime against football that we're allowed to exist.
Oh, my God. I forgot about that. I totally forgot about that. But, Chase, I know this was a way for you to sneak something in about the Falcons, because I get it. They're your home team, and we are going on a little long. But, Chase, what if I told you there was a football coach that cited the terrorist that attacked the United States on September 11th, 2001, as great communicators, and that we should be more like them? What if I told you there was a story today that an NFL coach did that in a training camp address to his football team? Who do you think would possibly be that stupid, Chase?
You know, there's a great quote from the Big Lebowski. Say what you will about the tenets of National Socialism, but at least it's an ethos. And you never want to be that guy. You never want to, like, directly encourage that kind of thought process by, I don't know, comparing the value of teamwork to the guys behind 9/11. Right after, apparently, a story about, like, the Niagara Falls woman who got stuck and never was saved, like that was somehow motivational. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't my team, Walter, so hopefully it wasn't yours either, right? Because that would be really tough. That would be a hard thing to have to process about the person in charge of your hopes and dreams for the rest of the season.
I mean, Chase, by saying Niagara Falls, you kind of gave away the answer. It was Sean McDermott. It was Sean McDermott. At St. John Fisher College in Pittsford, New York, McDermott's morning address began innocently enough. He told the entire team they needed to come together. But then sources on hand say he used a strange model. The terrorists on September 11th, 2001, He cited the hijackers as a group of people who were able to all get on the same page to orchestrate attacks to perfection. One by one, McDermott started questioning each specific players in the room. What tactics do you think they used to come together? A young player tried to methodically answer, what do you think their biggest obstacle was? A veteran answered, the TSA, hoping it would lighten the mood. McDermott himself has now admitted in their press conference today that this did actually happen, but that he apologized immediately to the team after. There is another source that says it happened on the field afterwards in practice and not like within, you know, a minute after him telling this story. But ultimately, quotes that have came from the 20 plus former team, former players, staff members, front office members, and some people that are still in the building currently. To delusional proportions, one assistant coach remembers McDermott saying in the locker room that the offense scored too fast and left the Chiefs too much time. It was such a ludicrous statement, the coach said, that it didn't move the needle. Chase, I don't really pay for journalism that often, right? Mm-hmm. I'm one of those, you know, millennials that are like, I don't want to have a newspaper subscription. But I gave Ty Dunn and his goal-long touchdown Substack the $8 this month to read this article. And if I knew that giving journalists money would cause them to create content like this, I think I would be broke. It's been a great week in Western New York. We're really, really excited to play the Chiefs on Sunday. It's going to be great.
It's definitely one of those where, you know, I just keep thinking about the recent episode on Behind the Bastards on G. Gordon Liddy and how he found a way to constantly compare everything to the Nazis, but as a positive. And I feel like if you're the kind of person who thinks, like, regardless of the circumstance, right, let's give him the benefit of the doubt and say it was spur of the moment and not a planned speech to talk about the 9/11 hijackers as a perfect embodiment of teamwork. That it hit your brain at all is a really fascinating thing in the human mind. And the rest of it just, it's hard for it to even register with me, because at that point you've just revealed what a weird person you have proven yourself to be. That is a thought that would cross your mind. Because if you gave me 1,000 instances of teamwork that I needed to write speeches for, I don't think I would have gotten to the 9/11 people. I really wouldn't have. And what I'm saying is that your offer to have Sean McDermott coach the Falcons next year, I'm going to have to decline. I know that it seemed like it would be really good for both parties for him to move on and for the Falcons to not have Arthur Smith. But I got to tell you, I don't think I could take this one on. I think we're okay.
Yeah, you know, in a week where we allow Von Miller to continue to practice and be in the facility, given some of the details that's come out about his alleged assault of a pregnant woman. Now, understandably, the victim, okay, they recanted, they pulled back, they didn't want to make it a big deal, but just the details coming from the police report, pretty disgusting stuff if it did actually, you know, was actually him that did it. And now this, again, super excited to play the Kansas City Chiefs this Sunday. You know, I'm so excited for football. And I think everyone at home listening to this podcast can tell how excited we are to talk about Napoleon, because we have spent almost 15 minutes not talking about Napoleon. And I am going to jump to the end of the podcast here real quick for you folks. I'm going to apologize to Chase for making him see this film. I don't know what his thoughts are on it yet. We haven't discussed it in that way. But I do feel like I would be unable to discuss this film without being upfront with the amount of contempt that I have for it. And I think that would come very clearly in my voice. It would be hard for me to kind of temper it and be like, oh yeah, this is great. This was a good part of it. This was well, there's some problematic stuff. Nope. I'm just going to put that in your heads right now. I hold this film in contempt. And we're going to discuss that, and we're going to discuss the good and the bad of the film. So Chase, right off the bat, other than me convincing you we had to see this film because it was a Ridley Scott biopic, and I am just addicted to them, what possibly interested you about Napoleon?
Well, so here's the thing, right? Napoleon's obviously a fascinating historical figure. someone that we all know to be critical to the development of the modern world, but often in the United States, right, gets reduced to a chapter in a history book, right? There's a moment in which he takes over after the French Revolution of the late 1970s, and you do have to specify because the French sure do have a lot of revolutions in their history. Shout out to them. More states should do that. But we know that he takes over, that he makes himself dictator, that he conquers a whole bunch of land and then loses it almost as quickly as he gains it, gets kicked out of the country, comes back one more time, gets kicked out a second time. And then France somehow gets turned into a whole bunch of jokes about being quitters, as if that was not preferable in many ways to wanting to conquer the entirety of the world because Napoleon is an egotistical maniac. Fascinating guy, right? Ultimately, someone who emerges from chaos and as a historical figure is very interesting to follow. So I'm interested in that angle. I'm interested in Ridley Scott, a guy who we've gone back and forth on in this podcast. I apparently was kinder to The Last Duel in the podcast than I am thinking back on it now. I think my opinion on the movie may have soured a little bit with time. House of Gucci, a film that I enjoyed despite its flaws. I was higher on it than you were. But I am not blind to some of the flaws that it had along the way. But Ridley Scott is always interesting. He knows how to go big. He knows how to create some of these dramatic, large-scale moments. And there are certainly some moments in this film that I think he does his thing very well. But really, the most important thing, and this is why you don't have to apologize for the fact that I went and saw this film, is because I got to support a local theater near me. The Vista reopened for the first time in several years, and it is a single screen theater that still shows all of their movies in real film, like 70 millimeter film. And so I saw Napoleon on its original film, the way that films used to be shown. And not to get all LA up in here, but may or may not have had Rian Johnson, the director of The Last Jedi and the two Knives Out films, among other things, in the same row as me when I watched the film, because he's a cool guy who likes to support local theaters, I suppose. But that is 100% a thing that happened. It's one of my few celebrity stories I could actually point to in LA, and I'll give him credit. I like supporting single screen theaters, you know, these local businesses that appreciate movies in the form that they originally took. So shout out to him for being there, I guess. So that alone, I guess, was worth it for me. But I imagine you didn't see a lot of those over in your neck of the woods.
No, I saw a lot of old people in my 1 o'clock showing of it at the local AMC. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of old couples. It was a little weird. It's a little strange. I was like, damn. Okay. I feel like I have to go get an early bird special after this. That's a little ageist, but whatever. That being said, I've said before with The Last Duel, and I believe also on House of Gucci, I am not really the sci-fi element of Ridley Scott, right? I'm not an alien guy. I don't think I've watched any of them, just because I'm also not a fan of the jump scare kind of horror element. But I'm a big fan of a lot of stuff that he's done. Hannibal, Black Hawk Down, Kingdom of Heaven, a lot of these more historical or more modern kind of pieces that are set with real people, right, in the real world, not so much futuristic. And I constantly am oh, Ridley Scott did something. Let me take a look at it. And, you know, House of Gucci, thought it was pretty good. Last Duel, I had some problems with. And Napoleon, I was like, all right, how the fuck can you screw up Napoleon, right? Fascinating dude. Really interesting dude. Who would I want to play Napoleon? Hey, who plays a really good, megalomaniac maniac dictator? Joaquin Phoenix. Perfect. Bring him from Gladiator. Have him just play his Gladiator character. It's gonna be great. And Napoleon is if you ask me, like, what my favorite time period in history is, it's, like, it's World War II. I'm really kind of fascinated by World War I into World War II and kind of getting into the beginning of the Cold War and the Soviet Union, right? I am already a middle-aged dad. I'm into smoking meat and I'm into World War II. So to, like, go back to Napoleon and to kind of think about, like, how do we get into the era of all of these intermarriages and, like, you know, the conqueror of the Europe prior to the Kaiser is fascinating. Like, it's an interesting look. And I was like, cool, what am I going to learn about Napoleon beyond the little stuff I remember from AP Euro? And Chase, I will say one of the first things that I learned about Napoleon is that apparently this man is a switch. This man, he likes to be dominating. He's like, no, you're mine. You do what I tell you. You're nothing without me. And then, like, an hour later, I don't know, the next day, is being told the same thing by his Empress Josephine, who's also cucked him out while he's out, you know, fighting wars in Northern Africa. So I didn't know that, and I didn't know I needed to know that. So thank you, Ridley Scott. I have now learned that Napoleon Bonaparte is a switch.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those things when you go into historical accuracies, which Ridley Scott famously told off some historical fact checkers saying they should get a life, responded to people who were on set criticizing some of his decisions with, you weren't there, so shut up. Which, you know, bold, I would say. I almost appreciate the energy that comes from that. But, like, one of these, like, some of these Napoleon myths about his sexuality and the way in which he carried himself are myths that were made by his enemies who hated him and always wanted to kind of undermine his kind of reputation, right? Trying to make him look small, when in all reality he seemed fine in bed. Most men were not attentive to women's needs in the early 1800s. I hate to tell you this, Walter, but there was a lot of sexism at the time, and women's sexual gratification didn't come up very often. And so the idea of, like, haha, this man is subjugates himself to the woman that he's intimate with, works its way into history regardless of its accuracy. But this is not a film that cares about historical accuracy, and I don't know that I want to judge it as such, because Ridley Scott certainly doesn't think that that matters. And if I called him out on all the things that he got wrong and nitpicked all of those details, I feel like I'd be missing the point, because he'd just look at that and say, well, shut up, it's less interesting. And I don't know what my response is meant to be to that. I guess ultimately the key for me is, like, this switch, as you put it, this relationship dynamic in which he is both this powerful man but also very subservient to this woman that he falls in love with, such that he often struggles to form words with her at all during the courtship process and allows himself to remain with her despite her openly cheating on him and this being well known within French circles. I think the big takeaway, right, is this is a relationship that clearly matters a lot to Napoleon and maybe shouldn't have been the thing that was cut whenever this film was worried about its runtime. And oh boy, did this relationship need a little bit more room in the film to be fully explored and appreciated for what it is, because Vanessa Kirby just owns the fucking film whenever she's on screen. And I really wished we got more of her, because that was what was most interesting about what this film had to offer.
It does give you kind of a very binary choice here, where what do you want to discuss with Napoleon? And you could have gone one of two ways, right? You could have focused on this relationship with the Empress Josephine and all of those interactions and seeing, well, what was she doing behind the scenes while he was gone besides fucking men 10 years younger than her, right? Like, what was going on in these interactions? And should have had way more depth to, you know, later on in the movie, it's this back and forth of writing letters to each other once they're finally divorced. Spoiler alert. And that should have been throughout the entire course of the film. And there is some understanding that the reason why these letters are part of the film and so widely known are because they are when Josephine dies, they are stolen and then later like sold as the private missives of Napoleon. I think like not just as an attempt to like, you know, discredit him or just kind of like discredit him, but just like, I guess he's an interesting figure. Why wouldn't I sell his letters to the highest bidder or to a journalist or to whatever? But that doesn't happen throughout the entire course of the film. And then you have the actual, I know you're going to say the Josephine relationship is the most interesting thing to you, but what would have been interesting to me is his rise to power. How does he become the Emperor of France? What is there about his tactics, in his battles? Because he is, you know, he is widely, you know, known for his defeat at Waterloo, right? That is a lot of what, when people bring up Napoleon, it is he lost at Waterloo. Right, that's when the British basically cripple the French and become the absolute dominating power in Europe at the time. But what gets Napoleon to that moment? Because you aren't going to get onto a battlefield with the British, where the British and the entire, you know, continent decides they have to fight you, without being a brilliant tactician or having a bunch of brilliant tacticians under you that you steal their ideas. And for the most part, and the little bit of Napoleonic history I do know, Napoleon is a brilliant general. And we do get some of these really, really crucial moments and crucial battles. The Battle of Austerlitz, where he basically baits the Austrian and Russian armies to, you know, get onto this ice-covered lake, right? This frozen lake.
Oh, and Walter.
You're going to tell me this is fake, aren't you?
Of course it's a fucking fake. So here's the thing. It did happen, right? He did eventually use cannons to break a frozen lake, but it was out of necessity. He was losing the battle and he saw an opportunity that emerged. It wasn't his plan. He didn't forethink this in this amazing 5D chess moment. It was the battle is going back and forth and we need to find an advantage. And oh, hey, I happen to acknowledge this opportunity within the chaos of the moment, and they utilized it accordingly. The film presents it as, look at how smart he is that he planned all of this out in advance. No, he reacted to the battlefield, which is what a good general does. That would be impressive in and of itself, right? But the film is not satisfied for him to just be a general who is good at adapting at what's in front of him. It has to make it so, no, he saw everything. He knew exactly where they would be, and he planned a perfect fight to specifically take advantage of that moment. And that's just not what happened.
But it doesn't even do great at that, right? I get this, like, one or two limited moments where it even attempts to show him that he's this genius, right? And that's ultimately what I'm getting towards. Is that if we go, okay, we can either show Napoleon the man, right? The man that is, in love with this empress, is, you know, besotted by her and is kind of, you know, trying to figure out that relationship and who is actually in control and who's in charge and who makes what happen, versus Napoleon the conqueror, Napoleon the emperor, Napoleon the general. And unfortunately, it doesn't do a good job at either. It feels very back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And not in this, like, you know, not in like an interesting way. It just feels like we made two different movies and then cut scenes out of both of them and put them together to create one jumbled movie.
Well, this is the problem of, like, telling Napoleon's story in a 2.5 hour long film instead of as a mini series, which is what this probably should have been, right? Like, you know, spend 4 to 8 hours really delving in deep, because it turns out Napoleon did a lot of things. He was kind of a big deal, and his impact is substantial, such that a single film is not really going to capture all of it. Now, I would say, right, that the film is admirable in its attempt to show off the duology of this guy. because there's a flaw in the great men of history theory that is often taught in the education system, both in the U.S. and in many other places in the world. This idea that greatness is measured by the amount of land that is conquered, by the ability for someone to achieve military victories and to accumulate power. This is something that's played into a lot when you look at the total war games that measure its win condition by how many territories you have, or civilization, which marks military conquest as a key way in which you can run and successfully control the world, right? It's this idea that that power, that military prowess, and your ability to take out those who oppose you is inherently good. And Ridley Scott clearly thinks Napoleon is a piece of shit. He is not subtle in how much he hates Napoleon and thinks little of this man, picking at the insecurities that plague Napoleon and undermining his authority, his mystique that he builds around himself at every turn, including even at the end, where the number one thing that we're left with as the credits prepare to roll is the number of people who died as a result of Napoleon's military desires, right? This is a film that very clearly believes that Napoleon was a real piece of shit, a guy who just wanted to conquer for the sake of conquering because he had a real fragile ego and he was smart enough to get away with it as long as he did, but was ultimately the kind of person that no one would want to get away with it as long as he did, which would be an interesting film, right? It's certainly a very interesting miniseries if you really gave it the gravitas to sit with people. But unfortunately, this film is not content to just show the critical failings of a man who believes that the measure of his skill set is the number of countries that he is able to conquer. This film wants to be, if not a love story, at least a story of how Josephine and Napoleon are so close to each other, how Napoleon's relationship with Josephine and the relationship that they build together over time is what really matters to him, that there is an emotional core that comes back to her, and his emotions around being, for lack of a better phrase, cucked by her, and being undermined and forced to constantly acknowledge that the woman that he loves is not capable of fulfilling the things that he needs in order to be seen as part of an empire, up to and including marrying a literal teenager in order to bear a child, because he believes that that's more important than staying with the woman that he loves. All of this is damning, and it's worth delving into and spending time on all the ways that he is a fuck-up in this regard, and the insecurities that so clearly mar a man who, when conquering the rest of Europe, would like you to believe that he is invincible and impenetrable. But it's really hard to do both of these things in the length of a 2.5-hour long film, and for a film that so clearly wants to call back to Josephine and call back to the importance of the relationship, it's a damn shame that that's the stuff that gets cut the most, because Ridley Scott really likes big action set pieces and he wants to do as many of them as he thinks he can fit into this film.
And let's be honest, he could have fit way fucking more if he decided, no offense to Vanessa Kirby, no offense to the Empress Josephine, I don't give a shit about that. I could have done without all of that, right?
Wow.
That's not what I wanted out of a Napoleon film. I want the film about Napoleon the Conqueror, right? The Emperor. And if you build something, right? If it's the reason he's doing this is because he's being pushed by his wife, right? That his wife is the one telling him, oh, you're not good enough. You need more, you know, constantly pushing him to go out and further prove himself, right? Then I could understand why that relationship is so important, right? But that's not the case there. The relationship is just, they're in a relationship And there is this sort of tete-a-tete going back and forth between them of they love each other, but who's really in charge, right? Who's in charge of the relationship? Who's the one deciding things? Is it just that Josephine is placating him because she is an aristocrat? And she says earlier, you know, earlier on, do you know what I am? Does it worry you? And he's like, no, I don't give a shit that you're rich and we just got through a revolution where we decapitated all the aristocracy. Like, she admits, I was in prison. Right? I was in jail, ready to be, like, murdered, ready to be guillotined, because I was a member of the ruling class.
Well, and specifically that I slept with a bunch of people to survive, because I was told that was what needed to happen. Do you care about my promiscuity? No, I don't. She then continues to be promiscuous, and it turns out, yes, he fucking does. Because the thing that's interesting about Napoleon to Ridley Scott, and you can agree or disagree with this as much as you want, is not when Napoleon is strong, it's when Napoleon is weak. And it's the reason that he constantly refers back to the Josephine relationship, because it is the epitome of Napoleon as a man who is so much weaker than he likes to let on. Napoleon doesn't stand up for himself in a lot of key ways. He doesn't fight for the things that he says really matters to him. He fights on the battlefield for his own greatness, because that's easy. Building an actual relationship with somebody, admitting to his own emotions and allowing himself to be vulnerable so that he can get close to another human being, that's hard. And that Napoleon fails to do that is a condemnation of him as a person. He may be a great general, but he's a shitty man. And that's what the film is ultimately focused on, is despite all of these successes, despite all of these moments of him as a conqueror, he is ultimately a petty little dweeb. Someone who says things like, destiny has brought me this lamb chop, as a as an excuse as to why he is owed things like an heir. Like, destiny is meant to give me all of the things that I want. It shouldn't be, I shouldn't have to accept any limitations. I shouldn't have to accept the people who tell me that I am a sword, even though that's the one thing that I meant to do. And the last quote that I love, right, is when he says, after being captured by the English, I'm the first to admit when I make a mistake. I simply never do. That's Napoleon. Great fucking quote, right?
And great, like, quote.
The idea that this is a man who is incapable of self-reflection, incapable of recognizing his own flaws, and that his inability to recognize those flaws is why he loses so badly at Waterloo, and why he loses so badly in invading Russia. Like, that flaw is accentuated when you look at his relationship with Josephine and his inability to recognize his mistakes and his relationship with the one person that he has any actual emotional attachment with. It's why that relationship matters, and why it's so fucking stupid that this film cuts so much of that. It's so clear that there's a version of this film where you maybe add another hour onto the runtime in which that relationship is much more greatly expanded upon, and in which you see the dynamics divulge over time. And instead, what we get is a situation where, like, there's no reason that Josephine should be attached to Napoleon at the end, where she's clearly struggling through heartbreak over the fact that they are forced to divorce. And there's this complicated relationship of, like, him going back and still seeing her despite all of these, like, the fact that he has divorced her in front of an entire country because she didn't give him a child the way he wanted. There's, like, these dynamics are interesting, and they're, I understand your idea of, like, wanting the conqueror, but to me, this is a film that so clearly wants to talk about all the ways in which Napoleon is limited in his scope and perspective. And if you're gonna do that, why are you cutting things from the one relationship that perfectly encapsulates all of his flaws?
Wouldn't that be more of a film about Josephine then?
And that's what they in the credits, when it goes to the Josephine letter and when it focuses on the Josephine stuff at the end, that's clearly what they thought they were making. That's the reason I'm so frustrated with this film. I think that was the point at some point in time. And then Ridley Scott said, well, it's already getting pretty long and I'm not cutting the giant expensive action scenes, so I guess the emotional core of the film has to go.
And this is why I say it was two different movies cut up and stitched together. Because I am going, I want more of my Ridley Scott historical action movie. I want more battlefield scenes, which are great, right? The battlefield scenes we have at Toulon, at Austerlitz, and at Waterloo are fantastic and right in Ridley Scott's wheelhouse, right? That is what I expect when I watch a Ridley Scott, you know, medieval era piece, right? Napoleonic era piece, right? Pre-trench warfare in World War I. That is what I am expecting, is these large scare battle sequences where he lets them get muddy. He lets them get bloody. You see a fucking cannonball absolutely concave the chest of a horse, right? Like you do in the first 10 minutes of this film, right? Mm-hmm. That is what I want from my Ridley Scott film. And I get like half of it. And then you, on the other hand, are seeing this, you know, and that's Napoleon the Conqueror. That is Napoleon the Emperor. That is the general. And you are instead bemoaning, much like I am with the battlefield stuff, you are bemoaning that you aren't getting more of Josephine and the relationship to show the weakness of the man that on the other side of things is conquering Europe. That he is still so insecure in himself and his relationship that while he is conquering Egypt and winning, you know, battles against the Ottoman Empire, essentially, he gets one hint that his wife is cheating on him at home and he commits fucking, he goes AWOL, essentially. Yeah,
he commits treason, right? For sure. 100% treason.
And the only thing that stops him from being, like, probably imprisoned and hung for treason at home is, like, when he gets back, the, like, people, right? The people that this entire government are saying, well, we're here for the people, like, are cheering him and are excited for him and are so happy for him to come back, this conquering hero, that, like, some sniveling little dude is like, hey, Napoleon, you wanna do a coup d'etat and become one of the three leaders of France? And he's like, eh, sure, why not? I'm the one that's ruling France anyways, right? The scene he has with the directory where they are, they're trying to accuse him of treason. And he's like, listen, I fucking came back because you can't run this country without me. It's in fucking disarray. Like, I don't know. It's, again, it's two movies happening at the same time that are probably, there's probably a great The General, the Napoleon Bonaparte story movie. And there is probably a great, you know, the Spurned Empress, right, by about Josephine, movies out there in all of the possible scripts that were written here. It's just so disappointing that they decided to put them both together and then cut, you know, some percentage from each of them instead.
I understand what you're saying about the idea that there may be two films in here, but the truth of it is I don't think there's a film that Ridley Scott is happy with in which we just see Napoleon the Conqueror, because I don't think Ridley Scott thinks Napoleon is a good guy. I don't think he's someone that he wants to be looked up to, or that he thinks that these military conquests are something that should be kind of appreciated and highlighted in this almost, you know, this conqueror sense, the way that so many people, when looking at like the early stages of historical analysis, look at a guy like Napoleon, right? There's a reason that the film closes with the number of people that died as a result of Napoleon's wars. Ridley Scott likes capturing the battlefields, the scenes that create these epic moments that are visually fascinating, and he is good at shooting those. But he also believes that all of those battles were pointless. He believes that they were entirely ego-driven, something that ultimately destroyed a lot of people, real people, in pursuit of a man who he clearly thinks very little of, as you can tell by how Napoleon is portrayed in every scene in which he is not on a battlefield. So the movie that you're talking about, I don't think exists, because I don't think Ridley Scott believes that Napoleon deserves a film in which he can just be highlighted for his military conquests, because everything else around the film is all about how maybe we shouldn't just deify people and make heroes out of people who happen to be good at killing a whole bunch of other people. A lesson that, I don't know, feels like it rings true through a lot of history, honestly. And I guess that's why maybe I'm a little bit kinder to this film than you are, is I do think the core of Ridley Scott's argument is correct. Napoleon's not a good guy. He's not someone worth admiring. He's not someone worth deifying or highlighting as this, like, incredible human being. He's someone who's really good at a specific set of skills that got a lot of people killed for nothing. For nothing. Nothing of value was gained by the fact that he was really good at killing a whole bunch of other people. Which is why it's so damning that he feels it is so important to keep those scenes in, because he's really good at those, and that's where the budget went, and that's the big historical moments that, like, people are going to remember when they talk about the film. When ultimately his whole point in the thesis statement of the rest of the film is, who gives a shit about his military conquests? He wants to have his cake and eat it too, and you can do that if you have more time to delve into all these other angles. But as it is, a lot gets left behind, which is a shame, because I think there's a lot here that is worth paying attention to and latching onto, and rebukes a lot of flaws in historical analysis around Napoleon that I think are worth delving into. But he doesn't have the time for that he should, despite the fact that this is a 2.5 hour long film, because he also wants to highlight how cool it is when Napoleon kills all those people that he then bemoans at the end of the film.
I don't need to be told that Napoleon is a bad guy. I know he's a fucking bad guy. I get he's a monster, right? And I think I can enjoy a historical war movie, right? A historical action piece, without having to be reminded, like, this guy's evil, this guy's bad, right? Like, it's not like Napoleon is some no-name that people have never heard of, right? Like, he causes the continent of Europe to be in perpetual war for a decade, right? Because of his desires for conquest and him trying to feed his own ego. That is the part that is interesting to me, though, in the same way that, like, I am way more interested in, you know, how World War II gets fought out, right? And the rapid expansion, and then how the parts of it and, like, are won back, and what the French resistance is doing, right? Charles de Gaulle is not a good person either. But I would be fascinated to watch a film or a documentary that discusses what he is doing prior to France being, restored after Nazi occupation.
But maybe that's a perfect example, right? When you look at World War I films and World War II films, combat is muddy and it's gross and it's harsh and brutal and terrifying. There's no glorification of combat in World War I and World War II. In World War II, at least, you get the idea that it was a job that needed to be done because the Nazis were that bad. But it's never portrayed as this romantic ideal. And Napoleon often is portrayed as this, you know, look at this man who in this Enlightenment era was able to conquer so much of the world. It's a myth that pervades through a lot of historical analysis and a lot of what's taught in schools. There's an entire game called Napoleon Total War that exists because the idea of conquering the world as Napoleon is attractive to a whole bunch of people, right? That glorification is there, and it's there in how these action scenes are shot, right? The idea that decisions that were ultimately done on the fly in reaction to emerging battlefield conditions are turned into these moments of brilliant forethought in which he has perfectly calculated all of these different elements of the chaos of war is this weird glorification of the myth of how impressive and intelligent Napoleon was. And he was a very good general. You don't need to add those myths on top of that for that to be true. But I think that's the kind of thing that does take away, ultimately, is that this film is in conflict with itself. And I don't know that the film that ignores those elements would be better for it. I think playing into those myths as they already exist, even if you know that Napoleon is bad, it is hard for a lot of people to see some of the badass war stuff that he does as it is portrayed in this film, and the sheer amount of land that he conquers, and not think, man, that guy knew what was happening. That's why the rest of the film is so important, because you need to show how deeply flawed Napoleon is as anything other than that man on the battlefield. But in that case, you need a lot more of the man outside of the battlefield. And it sounds like you wouldn't have enjoyed that film even if you'd gotten it. But I get the sense that even if you'd gotten exactly what you're asking for, I don't know that would have worked for you either, ultimately.
No, I don't think it would have in this setting, because I agree with you, right? Ridley Scott hates Napoleon, right? It is very clear that he despises this man, that he thinks he is a monster. I don't think he thinks that highly of Josephine either. I really think that he thinks they're both monsters and that they're kind of perfect for each other. There is some sympathy for Josephine, obviously, because of how she does end up, being treated by Napoleon. But then, those are consequences of her own actions too, right? That she does misbehave, that she does, sleep outside of the marriage, and that causes him, discomfort because of the other, the people around. What are we supposed to be doing? But no, I think the real problem that I would have with this film, ultimately, Joaquin Phoenix fucking sucked. I thought he was terrible in this role. And some of it may be, again, because I'm not buying into wanting to know about the man, right? But I don't think it was a good performance. I don't think he was captivating either as the general emperor or as, this wreck of a human being in the way like his performance in Gladiator did, right? I didn't see it. I didn't see even attempts at any kind of French accents, which, okay, maybe no French accent is better than a bad French accent. But you're telling me when they're, when they're calling out the commands on the battlefield, you couldn't do it in fucking French to remind me, like, yes, this is Napoleon, the French emperor, fighting the English, right? And maybe that's just nitpicky, but I didn't feel like I was watching a movie about Napoleon.
Well, fun fact, Walter, and I'm not going to mention both films because I'm not sure we're even going to do both films on the podcast yet. But two films that I think we may talk about on the show, I have seen recently that both have fully Japanese voice lines because they're Japanese films. And we put things in subtitles because it turns out that there is something that is lost in the translation process. And obviously, like something like this, right? Like Ridley Scott wrote the script in English. It was designed for a whole bunch of actors that can speak English. But yeah, you're right. It does remove from the Frenchness of the story. And for the record, when Ridley Scott was pointed out that the French largely hated the film, his response was that the French also hate themselves, so who cares? Which I almost want to have respect for, right? Like that's a very funny thing to say and something that I can kind of appreciate. But it all adds up, right? This idea that Ridley Scott feels like he shouldn't have to care about the things that he doesn't care about, but other people very clearly do, is a limiting factor on how far the film can go. And I was willing to look past a lot of it if he focused on the relationship that he thought was the core of the film, and we know he thought was the core of the film because at the end of the film, it's the one thing that he keeps coming back to. But he doesn't really do that either. And Joaquin Phoenix, I'm maybe a little bit kinder towards him than you are. I think he has a few moments in which he is able to, like, delve into the real social failings of a guy like Napoleon, someone who struggles to, like, talk to women on even a base level and has this distance between himself and everyone around him. Like, I think that part was captured well enough for me. But Vanessa Kirby is by far the best acting performance in this film. She does an incredible job as Josephine. Every scene she's in is better for the fact that she is there. And I would much rather watch more of whatever she had to offer than anything else that was in this film, which is, you know, ultimately more of a statement that, like, man, she's a really good actress than anything else. I think she deserved maybe a little bit better than the script she ultimately was forced to settle on. And I don't know, Ridley Scott has a history of having had to cut things to meet studio expectations, and maybe there's a version of this film that gives her a little bit more time that I think is more cohesive as a result. But the film is worse every time that she's not in it, as far as I'm concerned. And that's unfortunate, because the film isn't called Josephine, it's called Napoleon, and Ridley Scott sure involves a lot of scenes in which she's not there.
I don't know if I necessarily would have been super thrilled to see a film called Josephine. I'll be honest. Again, it's Ridley Scott, so if he did it, I probably would have given it a fair shot, right? Because I love his historical kind of biopic, or just historical, you know, action movies. I agree with you. Vanessa Kirby was fantastic in her role, right? You know, limited dialogue, but I go back to that scene where he is getting admonished by her and she's like telling him he's nothing without her, right? And like, fuck, that is some persuasive speaking, Miss Kirby. You did a very excellent job in sort of conveying that same forcefulness and with an air of believability that when Joaquin Phoenix is doing it earlier in the film, like, it's not believable, right? It was way more a guy looking in the mirror trying to psych himself up, being like, yeah, man, you're the man, you're the best, right? And then he goes out and he gets his bell rung in the first round, right? My heart breaks for her later in the film, right? Where Napoleon finally brings, you know, his son that is born via his second wife, Marie-Louise of Austria. And, like, I'm just like, does she try to drown the baby? Like, what happens here? And it's like, oh no, I'm depressed because this should be my life. This should be me. I should be the one doing this. And your heart kind of breaks for her, especially because she kind of dies, you know, without him anywhere near. He doesn't know, because he's been exiled. And then when he comes back, like, the first thing he does is like, oh, I'm gonna go see her, right? After I conquer France first, but I'm gonna go see her, and then she's dead. And like, she's like, he says to like her daughter, I don't blame you for her dying. It's like, motherfucker, you're the reason she died. Like, what are you talking about? But she does a great job with what she's given. But the rest of the movie is mundane. I don't want to use the word boring, because the action sequences I do think are good and there are some interesting moments. But overall, it's mundane, and not in a good way. Not in a way that's like, yeah, life is mundane, or yeah, this is just, you know, this is what it's like to work on a fishing boat, right? It's just mundane because it's not interesting.
It's a shame, because I think there's a more interesting film in here than the one we got. I do believe ultimately this just needed to be a miniseries. It needed more time. Turns out Napoleon did a lot of things. He lived a very interesting life. He was in power for quite a while. And the world shifted quite a bit as a result of his existence. So maybe that was worth giving a little bit more time to at the end of the day. But they didn't do that. And as a result, we get a film that tries to appease two masters and ultimately pleases neither, right? I think it is still something I'm glad I saw, if only because they think they're so great just because they have boats is going to be my new catchphrase whenever I need to criticize the English Empire. Destiny has brought me whatever my dinner is for the day is a great point as well. The scene of Napoleon like braying in the corner like a horse because he'd like to have sex with his wife now and would like everyone else to leave the room is pure camp, and I appreciate it deeply for the fact that it exists. But would I go watch this movie again? No, I would not. Which leads to my rating, and I apologize if I'm jumping the gun on this. I'm going to give it a 6 out of 10. I think the things it does well, it does very well. And Ridley Scott sure does know how to shoot an action scene to this day. And there are some good acting performances along the way. But this is a film in which the whole is lesser than the sum of its parts. And I really wish that it had more time to breathe on the stuff I cared about. Because I understand why you couldn't cut the stuff that I didn't. But the film sure is lesser for it.
I do agree, and I'd be very curious what this would look like from Ridley Scott if, you know, we had been given a miniseries, right? If we had been given 7 to 10 episodes and allowed him to really do in depth. But I'm just not sure what Ridley Scott would really say. Part of me looks at this film and goes, why? Why? What was the point of this film? Because I don't think it does a good job at either thing. I don't think it does a really good job of portraying him as this, you know, broken, conflicted, you know, man, right? And it definitely doesn't deify him, right? There is no deification in this. And, you know, even I is talking about Austerlitz. Oh, I fell for the entertainment value of it. Okay, fine. All right. I don't know as much about Napoleonic history as maybe I thought. Okay, I think that's a cool scene, right? That's interesting. But that doesn't deify Napoleon, right? It does try to make him look like he's a brilliant tactical general, but I kind of already had that thought coming in. I thought he was a pretty smart general to even get to where he did. And, you know, makes one of the grand blunders in history is don't invade Russia during the winter.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. Like, I mean, if you care about the actual man that exists, right, the portrayal here has a lot of propaganda that, you know, comes from the British about him just being like a Corsican ruffian that gets played into here. He gets credit for a lot of things that he definitely didn't plan out in advance. His relationship with Josephine is very different. From, you know, the realities of how it worked. And there's, you know, as a historian put it very well in criticizing the film, for all of Scott's fixation on Napoleon's battles, he seems curiously disinterested in how the real Napoleon fought them. And that's the real shame in all of it, right? Is like, you could make a film on the real Napoleon, the man that he was, and a much more accurate display of his faults and feelings and weaknesses and strengths as an individual. And this film plays into stereotypes on both sides and ends up creating something that is this weird mishmash that's a facsimile of the man as he was. And that's a shame, because we could have had something more interesting there. But I don't think that any version of it would have been fit in 2.5 hours. That's just not... Napoleon had a lot more going on. I don't know.
It's neither the man nor the myth. It is just the bland. And The funny thing is, I don't know if I brought this up on the podcast before, but I've definitely brought it up to Chase. My partner thinks I watch one of two different types of movies. It's either a war movie or it's a bad movie. And when I walked in the door after seeing this and I saw her and she goes, "How was the movie?" And I went, "Mediocre." She laughed and went, "Ha ha ha, I knew it. I knew it was going to be both." I love my partner very dearly, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't to like mock me of like, haha, you went and saw a bad movie. It was that she has something, has once again continued to prove her thesis that every movie I watch is either a war movie or a bad movie. I refuse to rate this higher than The Last Duel. This is a 4 out of 10. Mm. And maybe I need a little bit of a break from Ridley Scott. But hopefully you don't need a little bit of a break from this podcast and you want to talk with us a little bit more about Napoleon or a better movie, The Killer, or maybe Juwan. Go watch Juwan. Come back and talk to us about Juwan. And if you want to talk to us about any of the movies we've watched, any of the movies we should watch, Chase, where can the good folks at home find you on the internet?
You can find me at Chase Wassenaar on Twitter, chasewassenaar.bsky.social on Blue Sky. And of course, every week that we're not doing the movie pod, we're doing a video game pod in which we're talking about the games that we've played, different games every week, except for the last week of the year in which we go through what the other person has recommended and see if we come down on the same side on it. So if any of that sounds interesting to you, you should definitely check that out. We have versions of our feed for everything. We have just Final Cut. We have just Steam Cleaners. And hopefully you find a lot to enjoy, more to enjoy in that than maybe this film was unfortunately able to offer.
As always, you guys can find me at C80s_LOL on Twitter and at C80s.bsky.social. My Christmas present to you. The next time Final Cut comes out, the podcast will not only be on Twitter at Rough Drafts Pod like it is, but it will be on B-Sky, on Blue Sky as well. Because as Chase has found out from both Xander and myself with our journey of wrestling podcasts, we both need to be given deadlines to accomplish anything. with that being said, once again, hearkening back to The Great Daily Show with Jon Stewart, here is your moment of zen. Goodbye, Internet.